You're listening to the I Love You Keep Going podcast with George Haas. For more information, please visit our website at www.metagroup.org. That's www.metagroup.org.
So welcome, everybody. This is I Love You Keep Going. It is April 25th, 2024 at 7:36 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. And today, what I thought, or tonight, this evening, however you want to look at it, I thought that I would talk about addiction and also about the relapse prevention, I guess, is the topic. What happens that leads you in the direction of relapse, and then what do you do about that? We look at addiction as an attachment disturbance. And so what we're really looking at here are activation of attachment system and then the way to regulate those experiences. The attachment system activates, which causes a kind of seeking of safety or comfort so that there's a reaction to what's happening in the present moment. One of the things about addiction that's in terms of the attachment frame is that it's an avoidance strategy. So what you'll notice in organized people who are dismissing, that tends to be 30% of dismissing people are addicted. Or the disorganized crowd, 70% of disorganized people also have addiction, is that it is an overall avoidance strategy. And so the attachment system is suppressed and the conscious experience of emotion is also suppressed. But the way that that works is that the sympathetic nervous system is hypoactivated and the parasympathetic nervous system is hyperactivated. So you have a shutdown of the attachment system, a shutdown of the conscious experience of emotion, and a flattening of all of that by the hyperactivation of the sympathetic nervous system, which is meant to chill things out. But that's only in the conscious experience of the person. It's not actually what's happening unconsciously in the body-mind system. And so it's often without understanding that the underlying issue is this attachment disturbance and emotional dysregulation that leads to the lapsing. So when we say lapsing, what we're really talking about is a single use episode rather than a return to the level of addiction that you were at when you decided to stop the last time. We grow up in family systems and we learn the emotional regulation strategies that the family system has to offer us. So a lot of people who are addicts grow up in family systems where addiction is one of the primary means of emotional regulation. The thing about that, using substances or processes, we don't really make too much of a distinction between substances and processes in our conversation about addiction. The main difference between the two is that there's a tolerance factor that happens with substances that's much faster than with process addictions. There is some development of extremity in the experiences that are used to regulate on the process side, but that escalation is slower than the tolerance that builds up with substances. So if you have had a history of substance use, you may remember a time when half a glass of wine or a couple of sips of beer was enough. And then it was a beer, then it was a glass of wine, then it was a cocktail, then it was two cocktails, then four, then all of a sudden the level of dose that you need to settle yourself is actually impairing your ability to function. And that's that process of tolerance that builds up. Usually, it isn't until there's outside pressure on us that we begin to address that, and that happens faster with substances than processes because of the tolerance factor. If the dose is so high that it impairs your ability to function in order to calm yourself, that's when you encounter the external interventions. A lot of the process addictions can really be kept under the radar for long periods of time in a way that a sloppy drunk can't. What happens that triggers that? So when we talk about this really in these main conduits of relapse, this conversation is really not for the acute phase of addiction. This is the post-acute phase that we're talking about, when you've managed to get clean again and you've gotten your process addictions under some kind of harm reduction frame. One of the things also about substances is you can put them down and not have to use them. But when you have process addictions, which are related, say, to sex or money or food, it's not so easy to just set that down. I mean, you can't stop eating, right? You have to manage that on a day. You can't stop having some kind of financial life that allows you to live. You could completely withdraw from sexual expression, but that also would be in some ways limiting a kind of meaning in life that comes from those kinds of intimate encounters. So I always talk about this as an abstinence from the things that you can set aside and a harm reduction plan with things that you have to manage in order to have a meaningful experience of life. But one of the main things that happens to us is emotional dysregulation. And so if you grow up in a family system where emotional dysregulation is regulated through the use of substances or process addictions, the first place to begin to look is at this process of how one regulates. Most adults will regulate through thinking. And so you'll notice that you're likely to be thinking about using, which is okay. It often is regulating, but you have to examine where that becomes problematic. So when you look at the frame of emotional regulation, you see that if a response to the present moment is within your tolerance level of the experience of emotion, then we don't do much about it. It just comes and goes. It's when you have an emotional response to the present moment that exceeds the window of tolerance, then you have an emotional event that needs to be regulated. And if you're in the habit of using substances and processes to regulate, the mind thinks of using. So either it's a nostalgic tour of terrific experiences of using, or there's some kind of planning mechanism. I could use, this is how it would look, this is what I'd have to do, all of that stuff. That's part of the process. And if that were simply a self-soothing fantasy that regulated you, there wouldn't be much of a problem with it. But the problem with stressors that cause you into the thinking process that takes you out of the present moment, it also takes you out of your responsiveness to the conditions of the present moment. And what that can often lead to is an acceleration or an intensification of the stress of the present moment. And you're probably aware of the inverse relation between stress and your cognitive mind to understand things. The higher the stress, usually the lower the cognitive mind is. And you can get to a point in fantasizing about using where the stress level underneath that experience is so intense that you lose the ability to tell the difference between a self-soothing fantasy and an actual plan of action. And then you'll use. Using, of course, is regulating for most people who have processes or substance addictions. And what that does is it regulates the stress, and your cognitive mind pops back online and it's able to evaluate the consequences of using that wasn't really available to you when the stress level was high. and your cognitive mind was off, which often creates an emotional experience that exceeds the window of tolerance. This is shame, or guilt, or one of the different kinds of fearfulness of the consequences of that. Then you have another emotional event that needs to be regulated. And if your habit is to regulate it by using, the mind is thinking of using again. And so what we have to be really careful about is suppressing the thoughts of using as they arise and turning intentionally toward other means of emotional regulation. In the beginning, what we would recommend is that you use some kind of loving kindness or one of the heart practices as an alternative to the thoughts of using, so that you can begin to develop a sense of positivity in relationship to yourself. One of the things about addicts is that they often have an accompanying chronic low self-esteem that goes along with it. And to touch into that terrible sadness of that is often touching into an emotional experience which exceeds the window of tolerance that then puts you in the path of lapsing. Christian.
George, do you recommend that, like, for people with problems with addiction, they would stay away from certain kinds of meditation practices, or like kind of going into the painful stuff and just focus on positive practices until they can kind of build up a kind of more resilient set of strategies? Or
we want you to begin an intentional development of positivity and also an intentional meditation path that's oriented around mentalizing and emotional regulation. So we have it set up as the always cool, always kind grouping of meditations. So there's 20 hours of basic meditation instruction in there if you're new to meditation. If you already have a practice, most of the time you can skip the basics and go right into what we call always cool, which is really focused on mentalization and emotional regulation strategy. Always kind is a series of 56 meditations that take you through the heart practices. One of the things about people who grow up with addiction, if they have an insecure, organized, or a disorganized attachment strategy, is that the experience of childhood is going to be pretty severe. And that's going to lopside people on the side of a very negative orientation to the world and a very negative orientation towards self. And so you really do have to do a lot of practice of pushing that experience over onto the positive side. You can do it, and it doesn't take years and years of practice, but it takes months of concentrated practice to really push the mind into a positive response to self and a positive response to the world. But we do also wish that you would consider doing the deeper attachment work to reorganize toward more secure functioning. One of the main group of people who are using processes and substances to regulate their experience are also disorganized in their attachment system. And it's hard to understand when you grow up in a family system where everybody's pretty much in the same boat. They're all using some kind of substance or process, which is typical of family systems, or they're disorganized. And how different life is if that isn't what you're doing. Disorganized people tend to start bottoming out much earlier than organized, insecure people. So you might see, for instance, with dismissing people, really, they don't start getting into trouble until their 30s and 40s, whereas disorganized people, you know, you could even see them getting into trouble in elementary school, but certainly in adolescence, they're already in in trouble. Is that making sense? So it isn't so much focusing away from negative experience, it's a focusing towards skills development so that you can move out of the patterns of regulation. We don't really have a choice about whether we emotionally regulate or not. The body mind will regulate it, and it will use the tools that you've trained it to use to regulate. If you've trained it to use addictive strategies to regulate, if you get really distressed, you're not going to have much control over whether you use or not. And so what we really need to do is begin to develop alternative strategies for regulation so that the mind can choose those over the substance or processes to regulate. And it really is only when you've developed alternative emotional regulation strategies that you have a real shot at staying abstinence or in harm reduction for long periods of time. So the first thing is to address the thinking process that leads you toward thinking and using. We call it craving and urging. Craving is the automatic response to the experience of the present moment where you think of using. Craving is the intentional generation of thoughts around using, which are meant to be self-soothing. It doesn't matter whether the experience is positive that overwhelms the emotional regulation system, where it's neutral, or whether it's negative. Any of those can dysregulate the system to the point that you're looking for outside strategies to help regulate the internal experience, which is really what that process is. One of the other things that happens to people with addiction is because the emotional regulation skills are so unsatisfactory, oftentimes the body-mind system goes into depression to defend against the extreme emotional experiences. So it's very typical for people with addiction to be engaged in these cycles of depression. They could even be as quickly as a couple of hours that you're cycling in and out of depression. And a lot of people, this becomes a cause for lapsing or relapsing because the depression experience is so difficult to manage, or the coming out of the depression experience creates a kind of elation that feels good. So there's a sense of powerfulness about using something in order, in some ways, to express the celebratory aspect of being out of depression for a period of time. I know with my own history of use and abuse, the depression periods were often very debilitating in terms of my ability to really respond to anything. And when I came out of those depressive periods, I'd try to sprint at life. Because it was so alive, and I'd wear myself out with the participating in everything I could possibly participate in, the fear of the next depressive zone landing, where I just, didn't function very well. I mean, there were long periods in my 20s and 30s where I got out of bed and went to work and came home and got back into bed, and that's all that happened. And really barely hanging on to my jobs during that period. And then the depression would break, and I'd be taking Spanish lessons and going to art galleries and running around as much as I could, and in total fear that the next depressive episode would hit. So we look at that and really look at the strategies for emotional regulation that we use that tend to overwhelm the limbic system, which then shuts itself down. There is a defensive mechanism in the brain that when the neurochemicals that we add to create experience get so intense that it's, so saturated that it's possible to damage the physical receptors. And so that's when the limbic system comes down hard. The next Christian
It's kind of following up on the last question. I sometimes hear about people, I think people who tend to dissociate can sometimes have trouble with Vipassana practice. Like it really starts to like set them off or cause them to dissociate. So like the sort of obvious answer is just do a metta practice. But I wonder if you think that there are kind of gentler Vipassana practices that can be done for these people, or like kind of what the entryway into a Vipassana practice is. Cause like I find like a noting feeling states practice to be very emotionally regulating, but I've also had the experience that if you're noting a lot of negative stuff, it can kind of, it can be a bummer, I guess, to put it technically.
We have a strategy for that.
You can be like no positive, which is actually a really nice
practice. Right.
But I guess I'm curious just about this, like, not to paint Vipassana with this sort of brush of danger, but I'm curious if you kind of think of like certain entryways into those kinds of practices.
So dissociation is an emotional regulation strategy. Most of the time, in childhood, all children are somewhat dissociative. It's just the nature of the experience of childhood. They're very fanciful. My favorite example of this is that I was having dinner with my friend and his 5-year-old or 4-year-old, somewhere in that range. And we were sitting there and he looked intently at his dad and he said, "Dad, my burrito is telling me that, no, sorry. My burrito is telling me that I should tell you that you have to buy me a bicycle."
That's a smart burrito.
It was absolutely charming. My burrito is telling me that I should tell you to buy me a bicycle. Now, had a 22-year-old said that to me, I would be less charmed by it. In the process of maturation that happens in puberty, when the brain is pruned back to this barest scaffolding of already connected things, experiences, most people stop dissociating as a primary means of emotional regulation, except for the group of disorganized people who are dissociative. And that becomes the primary means of emotional regulation for them. So when you're looking at addressing dissociation, what we want to do is a combination of attention building so that people can be aware when they're dissociating and when they're not, because most people who are dissociative don't really notice that they're coming in and out of experience. And one of the things about dissociative people is that if you allow them to express the dissociative effects, they can keep up with the conversations with you and stay in connection to you. But if you get fed up with it, and here's the kind of experience that happens, a dissociative person will say, "Could you repeat that? I'm getting kind of lost," or "What did you just say?" Or "What do you mean?" All of those kinds of indications that you need to repeat what you just said because they weren't attentive to it. Now, we can easily assign volition to that and say that they were distracted and that they should have been able to pay attention to it. But because dissociation is an emotional regulation strategy, as soon as there's an emotional response to something that exceeds the window of tolerance, they dissociated. And so when they come back into balance, they ask you to fill in the part where they missed it because they were dissociated, regulating the emotional response to the thing that was happening. You following me? It's not volitional. They don't have control over that. And so if you say to them, I'm not repeating myself, you should pay attention, or you keep spacing out, or any of the other things that are shaming or cause them to have a guilt response, they'll stop telling you that they're phasing out. And what they'll do instead is they'll create a bridge that connects them from the last thing they remember you saying to where you are now. And these bridges are really inaccurate. And so what then ends up happening is you're in a parallel conversation with the dissociative person, not in the same conversation, because they're missing big chunks of it. So when we come into practice around this, we have to be aware that the coming and going is going to be this loss of attention. And so in the Vipassana experience, where often things come up where there's an intensity to them, they're likely going to dissociate out of it and just come back in. So that there has to be a lot of permission for that. And then also a lot of attention to just building basic access concentration. So in the beginning, I would be really directing them to be able to do breath counting up and down for 10 minutes without losing count, so that they can develop a strong attention. The way out of dissociation is to develop attention and develop emotional regulation in combination. So that's, again, where that would be pointing. And the sensitivity that they're coming and going. So that's the heart. That's the first real deep insight into dissociative people, is that they're actually coming and going. They can begin to recognize the mind state of coming and going. And then they really need to ask people to help them. So I just came and went from the conversation, can you kindly repeat it? Rather than something that's duplicitous, where they don't really want to admit that they're dissociating out of the conversation. And then when you're the compassionate response to them, of course, is simply to repeat it. And in some sense, try to help them hold the emotionality of it so that they don't dissociate out of it again. So if you're facilitating somebody who's meditating, you want to inquire about how those sessions are going, and sometimes adding a vocal labeling or something like that to it, so that they can hear the vocal label and it reinforces the attention. And then also when they lose the vocal labeling, or if you're facilitating them, you can have them vocally label. One of the things that I noticed in my practice is that for some dissociative people, they come and go so often that the most helpful thing for them is to sit with them while they vocally label the breath. And for long periods of time, so that it really does develop the concentration. So for instance, when I did a lot of meditation mentoring, I would just sit with people silently and listen to them breath count up and down to 10 for 25 minutes and just point out each time they lose it. And sometimes humorously, sometimes warbly, depending on who it was. I had one student who liked me to go every time he lost the count. But I have to say that I always, in the beginning anyway, felt that I wasn't really doing a good job, but then it was so meaningful to them that somebody actually sat with them and did what they actually needed. That it was an amazingly powerful experience. There's so much dissociative people have a lot of shame built up around coming and going from things. They also, one of the problems with adult conversations is that they're often emotionally charged. If there's conflict and you're trying to negotiate a conflict resolution, and then they can come and go from the negotiation and not really understand what they've agreed to. And then they don't do it because they didn't know that they agreed to it. And then they can be accused of doing that volitionally when they're really confused and don't know that they've made the agreements that they've made. Yet the other person has had the experience of them making the agreement, but not having been able to tell when they're dissociated and when they're not dissociated. If you develop that sensitivity with somebody, then you can see when they're coming and going. You have to wait for them to come back before you continue the conversation, or it doesn't actually make much progress. That dissociative experience also tends to produce a lot of somaticized emotional experience, which is these intense emotions that are stored in the body. So that's another aspect of focusing on relapse prevention, is the intense emotional experience that's somaticized in the body. You want to release that, right? That's all part of the emotional regulation system. What happens in emotional experiences is that the accumulation of the different emotional ways that we respond to things, if you don't have good clarity about them, conflate and create these intense emotional experiences when it's actually a combination of things, not the present moment experience. So let's say there's an emotional reaction to the present moment, which is 2 points of anger. But then you're from a family system where you regulate anger with anger, because 2 points of anger exceeds your very minimal level of frustration tolerance. The mind turns on a storyline that generates anger, and it say it generates 3 points of anger. And so you have another 3 points on top of the 2 points. But because you use anger so often to regulate the emotional experience, you have a lot of somaticized dissociative anger experiences in the body, which then resonate. So you have 4 of the old somaticized emotional experiences, 3 from the thought generations, and the present moment experiences 2, but you react at a level 8. And everyone else around you is experiencing level 2 frustration in response to the present moment. And so you become somebody who's reactive, that overreacts. Have you ever had somebody say to you, you're overreacting to this situation, but your experience is so clear in that intensity. And because you overreact a lot of the time and have no clarity about it, you become somebody who's unreliable. And then in intimate relationships, of course, you want to be able to tell somebody everything. But when you become emotionally volatile and unreliable in that way, what people begin to do is manage the information that they give you. And they begin to restrict the information that they give you so that you don't have a reactive response to it. And so this is one of the other pieces that happens with that. We have to, you know, colloquial terms like walking on eggshells and things like that to talk about the way that we hold people that are emotionally volatile. If you're emotionally volatile and people begin to restrict information to you, your intimacy is restricted. And then we get into this other avenue that is really the main cause of addictive responses, is you're socially isolated. You're isolated away from the capacity of other people to emotionally regulate you. And it's actually that sense of disconnection, that sense of isolation that is the main thing that causes people who get into an abstinence or harm reduction system that's functioning okay into relapse, that which is the entering into the attachment conditioning, the inability to form collaborative, supportive, loving relationships is really the main cause of lapsing or relapsing. And so what we want to begin to look at is the relational patterns which you function. Because addiction is an avoidance strategy, most of the time, the way that works out in relationships is that you love bomb people, really get them drawn toward you, and then you begin to withdraw from them so that they'll pursue you. Because the number one thing that makes avoiding people think that they won't be abandoned as if somebody's actively pursuing them. Christian.
Should I assume that when someone's engaged in that kind of like love bombing strategy, they're not fully aware of it, or is there a level at which they understand what they're doing?
So this is the volitional conversation again. When we look at the development of collaborative relationships, we all start out avoidant. We're all autoregulators. A newborn infant, it doesn't really have a sensitivity to individual people. They really are mostly inwardly involved. They look out at the world and they have a sense of wonder and they need their basic needs met. They get hungry, they get cold, they get hot. But they don't really have the capacity yet to orient toward a particular person. That happens at the earliest, say, at about 3 months of age, and then usually around 5 months, and the latest is usually around 8 months or so. We call it stranger anxiety in our country. In England, they call it stranger danger, which I think is actually a cooler day, where you really begin to develop the hierarchy of attachment and who's important and who is less important. People that you don't recognize are outside of the attachment system, and that causes you to be frightened of them. So in family systems that tend to lead toward addiction, nobody really comes reliably enough that you reorient as a child toward somebody else. That's really what's happening here. You don't learn to experience other people in a connected emotional way ever, because that never really happens for you. So when we say that you love bomb somebody and then you really pull them into where they're pursuing you, it isn't that you have a sense of other ways of being in the world and other ways of connecting in relationship. That's really the only thing that you've known. And that's how it's always worked in your family system. So you think actually that's the way that the world is. And that's what you need to do to get somebody to take care of you. And so you have a kind of pride in the quality of love bombing that you can do. You get good at it, and it's something that you take a kind of pride in, because you've developed the skills and you're good at it, the same way that we would with any of the other skills. There's no consciousness really that you're manipulating somebody else. And there's no consciousness that it's not a collaborative, intimate relationship, because there's no concept of that. Is that making sense? If somebody, disorganized people are often complexly disorganized, so they have more than one attachment strategy functioning. So they may have had a sense of somebody coming well enough and moving them in the direction of external regulating. So disorganized people have a different orientation than organized dismissing people do in this, in relational stuff. Disorganized people are often on the other side of the abuse and trauma line. So their orientation to relationships is somebody abuses them, somebody harms them. They've had traumatic experiences which the family system didn't help them integrate particularly. And it's usually through the attachment system when they're groomed, is the word we use in our culture, groomed into abusive situations. So that's the abuse that can happen in family systems. They're very reluctant to be intimate in relationships, because they think that if they allow themselves to open up and be vulnerable in that way, ultimately it will lead to their exploitation and further abuse. In people that are, in kids that are abused outside of the family, of course, it's whether or not the family system is close enough to help them integrate the experience. But often in situations where children are vulnerable to that, they're also neglected and also don't have the capacity to call on the family system to help them integrate it. Does that making sense? If you think that you can't turn to other people, and you're organized and dismissive, and you're good at love bombing and seducing and idealizing and drawing people in and then getting them to take care of you, that's one thing. But if you've been abused or subject to some kind of trauma and it hasn't been well integrated, and you associate relationships with exploitation and harm, it makes it very complicated to try and form intimate relationships. And in intimate relationships, of course, you have to be able to tell somebody else what's actually authentically happening for you. And that's often the piece that's missing there. If you don't do that, of course, you're not open to the emotional co-regulation experience of somebody else in relationship to you, which is the way secure people function. If we were to peg using here at this sort of high level of distress, and you had functioning collaborative relationships, and you were able to explore in a meaningful way in your life, the pain of living never really gets up to the level of the pain of using, the pain of being strung out. And so it never looks like an attractive thing. So you have a very low level of addiction in secure people, because it never really looks that good. But if you are socially isolated and emotionally isolated from other people, and you don't really have any reliable means of emotional regulation except for substances and processes, it's very easy for the pain of life to exceed the pain of using. And in that moment of extreme distress, the thought of using and the pain reduction that you're going to get from them actually looks like a good deal. And because you're in a stressed situation and you're not thinking clearly, particularly, you can make a bargain with yourself where that little bit of pain reduction is going to be worth the future consequences of it, and that will result in a lapse. And then the emotional reaction to lapsing kicks in, which is another experience that needs to be regulated. But if you're isolated from people and can't express that, the pain of that often then exceeds the window of the level of pain of using, and then you lapse again, and at a certain point it cascades into a full-blown relapse where you're using at the same level that you were before. So these are the main things: not really paying attention to your thought process around emotional regulation strategies that are thought-based, using afflictive strategies to emotionally regulate yourself so you push yourself in and out of depressive states that are related to thought. The somaticized emotional experience that comes from dissociative functioning and the intensity of that experience, it also takes a lot of energy out of life. So you're often in a drained position, and then the lack of capacity for collaborative, secure functioning relationships that leave you socially isolated and in pain. Those are the main conduits into relapse. I should also say one thing about the meaningfulness of life. Really, we need to be engaged on a daily basis in things that we find moving, the things that we find enlivening, enriching, full of meaning. And often the addiction processes limit our capacity to do that. And so in addition to not really feeling connected and being too isolated, we also are bereft of the meaningfulness of life. So we tend to use around that so that we can find some sense of aliveness, some sense of connection, some sense of enhancing the meaningfulness of life. But it, at the same time, using substances and processes interferes with our ability to actively explore in a meaningful way. And so we need to pay attention to that, because that absence of meaning can lead to a despairing situation, a despairing experience that we then use around to regulate. Is that all making sense? So why don't we do a little bit of mentalizing meditation so that you can get a sense of what I mean by developing the capacity to track how you regulate your emotional experience. And we'll start out with a little bit of concentration practice just to settle the mind. So go ahead and settle into your meditation posture. Right, let go of the meditation. How's that?
Utterly lost in thought.
Oh.
Kind of uncharacteristic. Usually getting the narrative generating takes a bit, but yeah, it was kind of interesting.
So not enough concentration?
Probably more exceeding my window of tolerance.
Have you tried opening the eyes?
Not with this one, but I can give it a shot.
Yeah, you need to up the awakeness. Good. So let's see, Saturday is the last day of the level one series that we're doing. So the fourth day, we're going to be talking about disorganization, and we're going to be talking about what to do about the different types of attachment strategy, and I'll be guiding some ideal parent figure protocol. I am going to be here next week, but the following 5 weeks, I'm not going to be here because I'll be in Europe. We're doing a retreat in Poland in the middle of May, and then a retreat in Utrecht in the Netherlands at the end of May. So if you happen to be in that part of the woods, come along. It should be fun. and then we're going to have some meditation and addiction classes in the summer, and we're going to do the first level two meditation and addiction intensive, which is going to be a 12-week intensive that's going to meet three times a week. So Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 6 to 7, there'll be a class, and then the whole program will last for 12 weeks. That will give you the didactic aspect on the first day of the week, the meditation aspect on the second, and then in the third, we're going to do different kinds of processes to begin to flesh out the relational, collaborative relationship skills. I've never done this outside of rehabs. I did it for years in rehabs, and it worked really well. So we're going to see whether we can manage to do it outside of that frame. Not for the acute treatment focus, but for the post-acute treatment and the long-term relapse prevention, so that you can really begin to develop a rich and meaningful life. We are going to do a level two in the afternoon on Tuesdays, starting in July, and then I think in August, we're going to start a level two meditation and attachment on Friday mornings for the people who live in also in Europe. So those are the things that are coming up. Christian.
So do you know what the date is of the first Thursday that you're back from retreat?
Look it up. It's the week of the 17th, so 18th, 19th, 20th.
Of June?
Yeah. It is, yes, the 20th of June is the first. I'm back. I offer the teaching freely, but I do hope that if you're able to, you can make a donation. There's a link on the website to make a donation. Any amount is appreciated. Help support me and also the work that Meta Group does. Really appreciate your practice. Thanks for coming, and we'll see you in a week.